This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from TAN Talk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And it's going to be 87 degrees here. Oh, that's fantastic. I'm happy that we're going to have warm weather again, although I am from northern Michigan. I do not appreciate cold weather, so I'm so happy that we are back in our warm weather season. Now, today's going to be a really exciting day. It's all lawyers. This is a lawyer show. At the bottom of the hour, I will be talking to Krista Castaneda, who was a lawyer for T. Boone Pickens for his last trial, and she's going to tell this wonderful story about how she got involved with such a famous man. But first, I'm going to start with somebody I wanted back on the program. I didn't know I was going to have him back so soon, but I am very happy to have Michael McAuliffe back on Joy on Paper. This is, it makes him two times in the month of March. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Patsy. Happy to be back.
Well, you know, this is my fifth anniversary month, so I've been celebrating all month. With favorite books and favorite authors. And so you were on for your release date of No Truth Left to Tell. And at the time, of course, I told you how much I loved it. I think it's just a brilliant book. And it's funny, you know, I mentioned, we didn't have that long to talk, and I mentioned to you that I love any legal books. I've always loved legal books because actually the first sort of grown-up book that I ever read was Earl Stanley Gardner. I read a Perry Mason book.
Oh.
I was 5 years old. Now, I started reading when I was three, like Beatrix Potter. And by the time I was four, I was reading Nancy Drew. When I was 5 years old, my mother was having her card party, and I think a lot of people have to start having card parties again, you know, just among their family members. And they were playing Pinochle. They came every week, and the four ladies would sit at the literally a card table, one of those folding tables that you folded out the legs, and they'd sit and they'd play Pinochle. And they were talking about a book that my mother had recently read, which was a Perry Mason. She loved Perry Mason books. And so I walked up and I started telling them all about this book that I really liked, you know, this and this. And of course, all the ladies laughed and they thought it was a joke. And my mother looked over at me and just winked because she knew that, in fact, I could read that.
Right, right.
So she was, you know, she didn't want to tell these ladies because, you know, in those days they thought, you know, if somebody could actually read at the age of five, it was rare, let's put it that way. So it was so cute, and I remember it so clearly, and it was the start of, and in fact, it was the start of many authors. Perry Mason, Earl Stanley Gardner, of course, with this series, started this interest in lawyers, and it just grew from there.
Did you ever think you wanted to be a lawyer?
No. No, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry I didn't. I wish I had become a lawyer. I cannot tell you. I have bought a Porsche, I think a Jaguar. I don't know how many cars for lawyers over the years. I have this love-hate relationship with lawyers.
Don't we all?
As a matter of fact, at one point, I didn't dare do it. I working on a screenplay. Now, I was a script writer, and so I've done scripts, and I had this wonderful idea about murdering a client who was murdering lawyers, and then it was a story within a story, so the the client was writing the story about murdering lawyers, and then she invited all these lawyers to a premiere of the movie, and they didn't know which one of them was going to be killed. It was sort of gruesome. Let me put it this way. That was a really bad time in my life.
Well, I'm glad you got through it.
Which is why I have on my program every month, I call him my Joy on Paper's legal eagle, because Bill Larson, he has a company, Larson & Larson. He is my intellectual property lawyer now, and he's also my patent lawyer. I have 4 patents. And, you know, I learned a lot over the years because I was, as I said, I wrote scripts in Hollywood. And one of the things that you learn when you're young, never hire an inexperienced lawyer. Never hire a lawyer who, when he walks into the offices of a really big law group where everybody is, they have a view over Hollywood, and you walk in with a little young lawyer who's so sweet. I mean, I thought he was so sweet, and he really liked me. And we walk into this law firm, and it's like, all I could see right away, all he wanted to do to be one of them. I think my case was over real fast. Like, okay, out of here, you know. So, but it is funny. I've had lots of lawyers on my program. As a matter of fact, you know, I have I do these little book promos, and so I had Robert Tannenbaum did book promos for Joy on Paper, and I like to do that. I always like to remind listeners of books that they should read, and of course he was you know he's a fantastic lawyer. He was the New York District Attorney in Manhattan, and then later he was the head of the Homicide Bureau. So he writes a series of wonderful, wonderful mysteries. So again, a talented lawyer. Lisa Gardner, of course, also was with the New York there in the District Attorney's office, and she writes wonderful books. So she's been on the program a number of times. So I just love law books in general. And another reason is I'm from the Northern Peninsula of Michigan. We're called Youpers, and there aren't that many people up there. And one of the things is they made that movie Anatomy of a Murder up in Marquette, Michigan.
Right.
Even today, you can go and people will say, oh, I was 5 years old and I saw Jimmy Stewart, you know. And so it's sort of that type of book was not popular in up north. Everybody up north read that book because the movie was made there. It was like one of the biggest things that ever happened up there.
Right.
So, you know, of course, when I got to your book, I didn't know anything about you when I started the book. Of course, I immediately, as I'm reading, I realized this guy knows the law. And as I never, you know, read any of the promos or the bios or anything. And of course, I discovered that you are so good as an author. I was amazed that it was your first book. No Truth Left to Tell is just a heartrending book. You know, it's about racism. It's relevant to today. And I just love this book. But I wanted to talk to you today. Let's talk about, in general, about the sort of what I call the joy of writing. And tell us more about you know, what influenced you, who influenced you, and how it came about. Because it's funny, you know, you know, I put you now in the John Grisham Scott Turow league, definitely.
Right. Thank you. That's a big compliment.
Well, you're gonna be an amazing. Your product over the next 20 years. I looked at your picture afterwards, and I you know, you said you were 30 years in as a lawyer, and I thought, well, he looks so young. Like, he looks like he just came out of law school.
Yeah, my My parents get the credit for that.
Well, good bones, I can tell you, because so you've got another 30 years of great writing, and I know we'll have wonderful books out of you. But tell us some of the influences on your writing and some of, you know, so many people, you know, do like books about lawyers. Of course, we all know Atticus Finch, and most people don't know that Harper Lee actually studied law.
She was planning,
or you know, her father, of course, was a lawyer, and she was planning to study law. So there's this great background that I think the mind of a lawyer is really great for becoming a novelist.
Well, I agree. The you know, my inspiration as a writer first comes as a reader of other people's books and stories. In my own personal experience, used the law and things that I've seen, people that I've met, to inspire me to share some of those impressions, some of those lessons and insights with others. But I principally am a reader before I'm a writer, and I think that helps inform how I go about my passion of sharing stories. I think people might be surprised at my early influences. I mean, I love Herman Hesse, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Peter Matheson's The Snow Leopard really spoke to me, and it was so well and eloquently and passionately written. It started a lifelong love of the outdoors and personal exploration and travel. So I have a bit of a strange mishmash of literary influences.
Now, of course, some of the legal books that influenced you, were you a fan of Scott Turow and Grisham? And
oh yes, I mean, John Grisham is a practicing lawyer, and Scott Turow was an assistant U.S. attorney, like I was for many years, and I feel very in some ways bonded and familiar in that his tale of writing Presumed Innocent on the train coming to and from work as a working federal prosecutor is very close to my experiences early on, trying to memorialize some of my thoughts and impressions while I was still experiencing the events that eventually, many years later, became No Truth Left to Tell. John Grisham was a practicing lawyer for many years in Mississippi, and so I actually have done a case down in Oxford as a federal civil rights prosecutor, and so there are obvious influences on me. You know, the genre is quite populated with talented writers. I think the reading public has a voracious appetite for crime novels and legal thrillers. Which is both good and bad. The good part is there's a, you know, a big market potentially for someone like me who wants to add their voice to the mix. The downside is it's a very competitive, high quality area of writing and novels. So you got to bring your best straight away.
Well, now when he first started writing, his first book, A Time to Kill, was actually rejected by, I think, 16 agents declined to represent him because the opening scene was so graphic. And then, of course, he went on to write other things that immediately grabbed grabbed audiences. And how did you find when you started putting out your book? Did you have any problems finding an agent?
No, I mean, I think I was a little naive in the process and sent the book out to a number of publishers and agents at the same time, and my time frame was rather compressed. So when the publisher got back to me directly, the one of the first ones, I jumped at the chance to get the book published and be put in bookshelves nationally, and so for me it was a relatively short period of time, but you know, it's just now there are so many different outlets for writers that you don't have to just depend or rely or hope for, you know, one of the big five publishers to take on your work. So, you know, it's democratized over the years, that is, writing and publishing. But the consequence of that is you have a lot out there, and you know that better than me, that there are a lot of stories being shared. That's, on balance, a very good thing, but not, you know, maybe not all of it is of the quality that you would want in terms of a readership.
Well, you know, exactly. There are all these opportunities, all these ways to get published today. And, you know, and part of it, of course, you have to, if you want to have an agent, then you just have to get out there and sometimes really push yourself forward and accept that people are rejected. I mean, it doesn't mean it's not the end of the world when you get some rejections. You know, you might get 16 rejections. I know that David Baldacci's been on Joy on Paper like 7 times. And, of course, it took 2 years for his first novel to get picked up. And I still remember it. It's so funny. I still remember that so clearly. Absolute Power. I actually remember when I read it, and I happened to be in Washington, D.C. And so it was funny that there I am in Washington, D.C., and I'm reading this book, and I was so impressed with it. And I thought, well, yeah, this is, we got another new star, just like I felt with you the minute I read your book. I said, this is beyond just, you know, I always can judge when I read a book that's almost, you know, it's literature as opposed to just you know, a book that might be an exciting, you know, story. But you, because of the character, your development of characters, I think that, you know, you are just really, really talented.
Well, thank you, Patsy. Coming from you, that's you know, again, you're such a you are, I'd say you're a subject matter expert.
Well, you know, I as I said, I get so many books, and I'm almost immediately now I can tell if somebody is just, I don't know, almost, it's not pulling a stunt. I feel like they're writing, and they might get an audience, but it's not rich, it's not deep, it's not something that's lasting. And in your case, I feel that you have that staying power. And so I was, when you were first on, and I said, well, when I first read the book, and I said, you know, I have to talk to him, because I think, you know, it's like that moment that whoever read first, you know, something like one of you know, these books, like John Grisham or whatever, you have that feeling. And that's why I just needed to talk to you, and I wanted you to come back, because I wanted people to get this book. In some ways, it's a difficult book, because it the story is harsh, and it's set in Louisiana and in, you know, in a time period where there was all this hatred and all this ugliness and all this. Stuff that we don't want to face. But you created a character in there, Nettie Wynn. You know, she's a victim of this hatred, but she's so real that anybody who reads it will never forget her.
Yeah, well, that was part of my intent. As we've discussed, I'm thrilled that you think that she is memorable and affecting. That's exactly why I write, is to make those types of connections with readers, and we just get the benefit of knowing each other through these conversations also. So that's the the plus.
Yeah, you know, it's like To Kill a Mockingbird. You hear the name Scout. It doesn't matter. If you ever are just on, people will say the name, you immediately know the story. It immediately comes back to your mind. And forever, if people just say Nettie, they go into like, yes, I remember how she felt. I remember her standing at the window. I remember the emotions that she went through. And that is real talent.
Well, great. I'm so happy to hear that. We should all have a Nettie Wynn in our lives.
I agree. And so, you know, I'm so grateful that you came on today, and that I can help continue to promote this book. And I will do so when I talk. You know, I talk more and more. I'm invited to more and more events where I get to talk to authors and would-be authors, all those people dreaming of writing. And they ask me for recommendations. And I immediately think of No Truth Left to Tell, because it is a book that all authors should read, and everybody really. And now in this period where everybody's in the house and everybody's thinking, we want a better world after this. We want something better. If they read a book like this, it might start sort of clicking in their brain. Yes, we have to stop the hate. We have to stop all of this division. We have to try to find the goodness in people. And I think that's what your book does.
I agree. I agree. At least that was my goal, and I'm so happy and pleased that you connected with the story, and it's always so enjoyable listening and talking with you.
Well, I want to thank you twice. You're the only author I'm going to have on twice in this marvelous month of March that I am celebrating the 5th anniversary of Joy on Paper. What is your website where people can go to see more about you?
You can go to the book's website, notruthlefttotell.com.
Okay, that's the best one, I think. Go there, and it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and if you don't want it delivered, it's in Kindle, and it's a wonderful book to read. A hard book in many ways, but so worthwhile. So, again, I want to thank you, Michael McAuliffe, so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
No, you're very welcome, Patsy.
Okay, bye-bye now, Michael.
Bye.
Okay, let's go to commercial, Ed, and then we come back. I'm going to talk to another lawyer. As I said, this is a legal day. Okay.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660, or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. And I am back, and it was really a thrill to talk in the first half hour to an attorney whose first book I think is just fantastic, and it's called No Truth Left to Tell. And now I'm going to talk to another lawyer, so this is going to be lots of fun. And I want to welcome to Joy on Paper, Krista Castaneda. Krista? She's not here yet. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Okay, well, I thought she was on. Well, we'll hope that she'll call in a minute. She's supposed to be calling. What can I say? You know, this is a live radio, right, Ed? And Ed is watching the phone, and I'm sure she will. It's been an exciting time. This is a book that I've it's about T. Boone Pickens, and having lived in Texas, of course, we were always listening and hearing about him, and so I just. You know, thrilled that she's going to be on in a little while, I hope. And if not, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to just keep talking because there's lots to talk about. But she's supposed to call any minute. And meanwhile, I want to thank everybody for all of the wonderful, wonderful messages I've been getting and the lovely, lovely texts and emails and cards. I got some wonderful handmade cards, and I really do appreciate that. It's so amazing, and I want to thank all of you for doing that. One of, you know, last Tuesday I spoke to Tasha Alexander and Andrew Grant, and as I mentioned in that program, and we talked about it. Andrew Grant is taking over for his brother, and he's going to be, he's becoming Andrew Child. He's taking over for Lee Child, of course, who, the creator of Jack Reacher. And it's going to be really exciting to you know, he's taking it over. And I have always been a fan of Andrew Grant and his writing. It's a more, I always thought of it sort of a little more sophisticated. Andrew writes about characters who have, you know, might wear handmade suits and things like that. And so it was funny when I was thinking about Jack Reacher. Jack Reacher is a different character altogether, but Andrew is the baby brother. I think they're 16 years apart, so he's very quite a age difference. And he was reading Lee Child before Lee Child was ever published. So it's going to be great. And now we have, I'm so happy, Krista Castaneda. Hi, Krista.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, great. Oh, wow. I just finished a call with Michael McAuliffe, a lawyer. So today is my sort of double lawyer day. And this story is so amazing. When I first heard it, I thought, wow, how amazing that a lawyer gets to work with T. Boone Pickens. As I said, we lived in Texas a long time, of course, heard about him all the time. And so you have to tell us about this book, The Last Trial of T. Boone Pickens. Your story is amazing.
I'm happy to do it. Yeah, it is a pretty amazing story. So I was T. Boone Pickens' lead trial lawyer in a huge oil patch dispute. You know, T. Boone Pickens was an oil investor, and he bought a piece of the most prolific oil play of his lifetime, only to be cut out of the deal by the defendants. And so we tried this case in Pecos, Texas for 5 weeks. It's the story of, he was 88 at the time, the story of his last courtroom fight, and me, his younger woman lead trial lawyer, and our friendship, really. Him, a diehard Republican, me, a Democrat who ran for Congress, all of the back and forth of trying to win a lawsuit and trying to stand up for what was right in the oil patch. And I was so honored to have the, you know, inspiration to write it, and I hope people want to read it.
Well, it's so well written. I was just talking about how so many lawyers have been on my program, like Lisa Gardner, Robert K. Tannenbaum, of course, David Baldacci, all lawyers. And so the legal profession really teaches you how to write. And it's wonderful when lawyers turn it into fantastic stories. And this story, it's almost unbelievable. You know, it's like, it's real. It's not a novel. I mean, it's happened, and you lived it, and you write about it beautifully.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Yeah, there were so many great stories that came out of that trial. But what I also wanted to get across to the readers is just kind of the sense of what it's like to be in the courtroom, behind the scenes. You know, shows like Law and Order do a great job of telling you, you know, little tiny pieces of what's going on, but what actually goes on is so much more complicated, and it's a little like being in you know, the middle of emergency surgery. Things are constantly changing, and there were some really dramatic moments.
Well, that's why I say, I mean, this is like almost like an action novel. I mean, you have us on tenterhooks. We don't know what's going to happen, and things are always changing and popping, and it's so exciting as a story. And of course, I got a smile on my face. I filled up my car this morning, and I was paying $2 a gallon for petrol, and I was thinking, what would T. Boone be thinking about this?
Isn't it crazy? Yeah, I mean, it's a wild time right now in the oil markets and everywhere else.
Whoa! Would he have loved to be going through this? Tell us about him, because what you discovered and what you know, sort of the public didn't really know that much about him, except that he's rich and But tell us about him as a person and what you found so intriguing about him.
So I met and worked with him later in his life. I had known him for about 10 years by the time we went to trial. I used to be a lawyer in very large law firms. I was a partner in some of the largest law firms in the world. And he had been my client when I was there. I took a little hiatus from the law to be a partner in an international PR firm and decided I really missed being a trial lawyer. So I opened my own shop and happened to come back to him through, you know, they thought they had a, quote, small contract matter, end quote, that I should take a look at when I opened my own law firm. And so I come to discover it's really a billion-dollar dispute, and it's over some of the most important oil rights in the country. But I put that all in context because you asked about who T. Boone was. T. Boone was an incredible thinker to the end of his days. He was willing to take risks to stand up for what he believed in, even when what he believed in was hiring, at the time, a solo woman practitioner, when many, many people of his stature would have hired the biggest law firms in the world. He hired me. He took a risk on me to win that case for him, and we did it together, and he was the guy who, at 88 years old, sat through every day of a five-week trial, even at the ultimate expense of his health, but he needed to see it through. He was that kind of guy. He was hilariously funny at times. He was obstinate at others, and I've got some bits in the book about, you know, some of our spats. But at the end, he was a dear friend, and I miss him a lot.
Well, you could, in the book, we realize that this connection, and really, when you think about it, knowing, you know, in having lived in Texas and actually having been involved with some of the biggest law firms in Houston, I'm I had my own lawsuit going on. I wish I had hired you because I did not get what I wanted from the very, very big law firms because they really did mess things up for me. So when I'm reading this, I kept saying, "Oh, where was she when I needed her? Where was she when I needed her?" Because it would have been wonderful to have faith in my lawyer. I never did, although I was working with the biggest law firm in Houston, and you know what it is. I never had faith in any one of those lawyers because nobody really cared, you know? And you cared. And that's...
Oh, I did care. And for me, being somebody's lawyer has always been a personal relationship. You know, I don't take on 25 cases. I take on big cases, and I give them my full attention and my staff's full attention. And, you know, I think that's really what the law requires, but the economic model of most of these law firms doesn't allow it. I'm sorry you had that experience, and I know lots of people have that experience. And at the end of the day, justice, while I think it comes over the broad swath of many cases, it may not feel very just in any particular case.
Oh, no. It can make you... let's just put it this way. I worked for a while. I didn't actually do it. I was thinking... I had like a year where I was thinking about all sorts of plots for... for writing a book about a client who murders lawyers. It's a very good book, and and I wrote notes for it, and then I thought I better stop this before I get too carried away. It was sounding good to me, you know. But I might go back to it now. I've had some years of calming down, and and I no longer, you know, live in Texas where I could carry a... But let's just put it this way. I think that he was a good judge of what he needed, and finding that in you, I think the story is reading so well. And now, you haven't written a novel yet.
I have not.
But you are going to now.
This is my first attempt as an author.
No. This is your first attempt. You've written a story that is so good that once this is what happens with lawyers, and it happened with Baldacci and Grisham and every... You have that point where you realize, whoa, I can write. I can really write and grab people. And I'm sure that there are novels in you coming out, and
you're very kind to say so.
Well, you know, it is important, I think, in many ways. You know, having books that cover different subjects in the law, it does help people to start understanding things and start perhaps reevaluating different situations. When they're looking for a lawyer. And I think in your case, if a person is looking for a lawyer, they will look and say, would this lawyer have this passion? Because to win, to be really a great lawyer, you have to have a passion for your case. And you certainly had that with T. Boone.
Yes, that's true, and it is a partnership. You know, he also had a passion for his case, and you know, in that way, he was kind of the perfect client. He was sophisticated enough to bring all of his experience and expertise to this oil patch fight, and give me his knowledge base and his perspective. He was a master communicator. You know, he spent decades perfecting, you know, how he talked to people about the things that he was interested in. And so by the time he took the stand in my trial, he was really, really very effective as a communicator in telling the jury his side of the story. You know, completely different exercise for him. You know, a man who was used to being on, you know, CNBC every day and, you know, all these national news programs, and then to be in front of 12 people in West Texas deciding his fate. You know, completely different kind of exercise in how to communicate a point, but he did a beautiful job. I will say, though, it wasn't without turmoil because he, again, wanted to do things his way, and I had some ideas about how we should do things my way, and there's some dramatic tension in the book about that.
Well, just picking a jury for somebody so famous has its own dynamics that is unusual compared to most when you're picking a jury, the jury doesn't know anything about the person. But of course, in Texas and particularly in that area, everybody knew about him. So tell us a little bit about what that felt like when you're picking the jury.
So it's such an interesting exercise to pick a jury, and especially in a small town like this. So Pecos, Texas, I think that the general pop, it's hard to tell now because the oil boom has got all these people living there, but the general population, I think, is around 5,000 when we were trying the case. And so we called down, because it was such a big case, we called down, I want to say 120 or 140 people, packed the courtroom. And, when you're picking a jury, you're trying to do two things. You're both trying to figure out who will vote against you, your side of the case, but you're also trying to talk just a little bit enough about the principles that will govern your case to get them start to thinking about, the ideas. You're planting the seeds. And so I hired a brilliant local lawyer to help me with that, because having local relationships helps a lot. His name was Bill Weinacht, is Bill Weinacht. He's still working out there. And it's a great story, just what he did to help pick that jury. But I will tell you, the strongest theme was paperwork. So the defense contention was that T. Boone signed up for the deal, but then he said he wanted out of the deal. And, of course, we didn't know that they said that he wanted out of the deal until years after, when we find out, oh, the deal actually made a ton of money, and what happened to T. Boone's 15%? Well, Bill emphasized the need for paperwork. You know, in all of our most important affairs, we make sure if you're buying or selling something, getting a divorce, getting married, you've always got a signed piece of paper that says it's official. They didn't have that in this case. And so that was how we picked the jury, was trying to figure out who understood and was committed to the idea that you got to have paperwork to get somebody out of the deal. But that in and of itself was a fascinating story to write.
Well, it was funny. You see on television, you see in these shows people picking juries, and now, of course, now we have what's that one, the jury guy, Bull, and you see this analysis of the jurors and all this stuff that they do. Of course, you didn't have such a sophisticated thing, I don't think, as Bull, but I was for the first time in my life, it's crazy, I was never called for jury duty. And not too long ago, I was called for jury duty, and I was surprised at the questions they asked, and I was surprised at the things that the jurors would admit to. The potential jurors would admit to. I mean, they would get up and they would talk about things that I was like, what? So I mean, and they'd say, well, I could judge this, but on the other hand, my brother-in-law, who's a real low life, he's been arrested so many times, so I sort of hate, and I'm thinking, how do lawyers...
It is an interesting exercise, yeah. So the jurors, we trial lawyers, we want to hear as much about the jurors' perspective as they're willing to share, and as the judge will give us time to hear, because it's those things that tell you whether or not somebody can be fair to your side of the case. You've got to expose as many of those things as you can.
But it's still, and isn't it a miracle in so many ways that we can, in this country, we can get a fair jury. We can get jurors who, might not be... they don't all have PhDs. They don't all, it can just be the ordinary person using their ordinary common sense. And I think that's almost magical.
It's certainly, and I think juries get it right. You know, you may disagree with the result in any one case, but over, the broad course of all the jury trials we do, I think they get it right. And I think the judges work really hard to get it right. And I think that we need to support and fund our legal system, because it is one of the ways that we make sure our unique American system is protected. You know, the whole system of government does rely on the ability for courts to function correctly. And so, yeah, you're exactly right. It's a very unique experience, and I'm sure it was a unique experience for these jurors to sit through 5 weeks of this.
And looking back, I am so sorry that I did not select to have a jury trial. I think if I had done a jury trial in Houston, I would have won, because I was in the right. I'm still telling you, I was in the right. But I suppose I can't say it, or somebody will sue me or something, but let's just say I made a serious mistake that one judge could make a decision based on perhaps other relationships that I didn't know about. I will say that, unfortunately, sometimes in Texas it was funny. You know, you would have sometimes a lawyer who would come in cowboy boots and be big, handsome guy. And I'm not even going to go there. But I'm going to write that book now.
Sounds like it might be therapeutic.
I think so. You see, I still have it, and it's 20 years ago. You know, I'm like, oh boy. So I just want to tell you, I think this book is wonderful. It's called The Last Trial of T. Boone Pickens, and your name is Krista Castaneda, and who you're with a law firm. You are the law firm, right?
I own my own law firm. That is correct, in Dallas, Texas.
You are your own law firm, and you are, inspiration also to lawyers who, and there are, as happened to you, you work in a big law firm, and you are sort of lost, and sometimes there might be a case where you really care about the client, but the big bosses don't let you devote the time that you think you need to. And it is a sort of some often the bottom line of the billable hours and all of that stuff. So I think you give hope also to a lot of lawyers out there. But you're an excellent writer. You tell a wonderful, exciting story. And I have a feeling, have you started a novel yet?
I haven't.
You haven't.
I haven't.
Okay. Well, you know, in case you are among, with like all of us, housebound or office-bound, perhaps you'll start writing your first novel, and then you will be back on the program, right?
That sounds great. It was so enjoyable.
Okay. Meanwhile, is there a website where people can find out more about the book?
Yes. LastTrialOfTBoonePickens.com is the book website. We are on Facebook at #LastBoone and also on Twitter. And it's available for pre-sale on Amazon, and it will ship April 5th.
Well, people, if you're stuck in quarantine or you're self-quarantining yourself or whatever you're doing, and you're not going out buying petrol for $2 a gallon, pre-order this book, because when you get it, it'll keep your mind busy for a while, and then you'll be thinking, boy, if I ever need a lawyer, I know who I'm going to call, Krista Castaneda, because she is a lawyer with passion and talent, and I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye.
Wow. Okay. Well, she was worth waiting for there for those few minutes. It is a really, really, when they sent me the book when it, they first had the PDF version, and I got it, and I'm reading it, I'm like, wow, this is exciting story. She did a brilliant job. T. Boone himself was a fascinating person. So you'll just now with all this interest in the whole time here of petrol and all of this, it's exciting, and you will love this book. I was really thrilled to get it, and the thrill that I got to talk to her. Another great, talented lawyer, and I know that once they start writing, they can't stop, and they realize how much fun it is to be able to go out there and talk about the books they write. So I'm sure next year she'll be here, and with her first novel. And the thing is, you could be here too next year. Now, if you're distancing yourself from everybody, and you're in the house, what are you going to do? Don't just waste your time. Start writing, because this is an opportunity. You might look at it as an opportunity. I am hopeful that in a year from now, I'm going to be getting a lot of books written by people who self-quarantined. And I just would say one thing. Don't write too much about the self-quarantine. Come out with a new story. You might tell a family story. If you are a family, suddenly you are all home together. Take a subject and write a book and have each of the people in the family write a section. It's fascinating what you could come out with. So you might want to write a story about your family. You might want to do sci-fi. You might want to come out with fantasy, whatever. And each member of the family could come out with something different. And then at the end, you can put it all together, because it's an opportunity. Don't look at it as something terrible right now. It's hard on everybody. But you have the opportunity to write and more than a page a day. Usually, you know, I tell people a page a day. Right now, I think if you're in the house, you could do 20 pages a day. And it's not too difficult once you are on the flow. This is the important thing. Just look into yourself. Find the character, a character that comes alive in your head. And then just run with it. And just start working. Start typing. Start writing by hand. It doesn't matter how you do it. Because one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, like Olive Grisham's. Think of all of his wonderful books that turned into major motion pictures, or streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. And you won't know if you don't start writing. And this is a perfect opportunity. Keep your mind busy. Think nice thoughts. Read well, and read across all the different genres, so your mind is full of words, and they will all come together when you start writing. And meanwhile, say something nice at a distance to someone today. And I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. And we're divided by a big glass window, so we're really self-distancing all the time. And all of you, be careful out there. And just take it easy. Calm down. And find the joy. And that's what I want you to be. Fill your life with joy in your writing. And just having this opportunity to be together. Okay. Bye-bye now.